My name is Larry Rasmussen, and this is the last in a series this week on ecology and ethics. Originally, I had announced the title for tonight as What Do We Do Between Coffee Breaks? Because I thought at the end of a series, we should have a kind of so what session. Now, having talked about these things, where do we go from here? But I changed that topic to environmental racism, the next sin, for two reasons. One is that it was a topic that wasn't being discussed in the village this week, even though we've had a good bit of attention to issues of environment. And it's a very important issue, and I didn't want the series to conclude without us talking about it. Having not done so in others, thought we'd do so tonight. And the second reason is that there's such a turnover on the weekend that we essentially have a new village over the weekend, and it didn't seem proper to end a series when many of the people would be coming to this session as the first one. So where do we go from here would end up being the first session rather than the last. Thus, the switch. I'm proposing as a format tonight that we have a very short presentation on my side to start with, just a few minutes, and then we go into a discussion that I want us to carry on for 15 or 20 minutes, and then I want to make a short presentation of the history of environmental racism and what I'm also calling environmental apartheid, and then we'll discuss following that until time for Vespers, and we should break here about 7:45. So, first, a very short statement on my side to open up a discussion from all of us. I was teaching in Berkeley last week. And one day, we took a field trip as a class in ecology and ethics to Strawberry Canyon. Strawberry Canyon is just up the canyon from the University of California campus. It is a stunningly beautiful environment. There are three major institutions clustered together in these hills of Berkeley. One is the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories, nuclear fission and related research. The second is atmospheric aerosol monitoring station and research on atmospheric aerosol, the stuff that's breaking up the ozone shield. And the third is the botanical garden with plants from all of the continents except Antarctica and from all climatic zones. One of the purposes of the botanical gardens there is to prevent extinction of endangered species. Now, I told the class, when you understand the relationship of those three institutions, the Livermore Berkeley Laboratory, the Atmospheric Aerosol Research Station, and the Botanical Gardens, with their preservation of endangered species, you will understand a very large segment of the modern world and why it slowly destroys planetary life systems. There is a missing piece, however. The area adjacent to these three institutions is designated an ecological study area. Human access is limited, and there are to be no human beings living in the ecological study area. And I said to the students that progress will be made, and maybe even the reign of God will come, when, looking out from the hills of Berkeley to inner city Oakland, which is within sight of Strawberry Canyon, Inner city Oakland is designated an ecological study area. Some people already consider it so, but not most, and very few people with clout. The best kept secret in the ecology movement is the unheralded environmental movement in communities of color. Now I want us to discuss, why is this so? Why isn't the environmental movement among communities of color known? Why isn't it news? Isn't environmental degradation the most ecumenical of issues? Isn't the threat to planetary life support systems the issue that cuts across all borders? Isn't it the one that affects everybody and everything? Spent most of this week trying to say so. But now I want to ask for our collective wisdom on this. Why are the environmental movements among communities of color not known? Yes, Roxy.
In my experience, the reason is the people of color have never joined the traditional environmental groups.
Why?
Well, we thought for a while it was because we weren't inviting them in, and I think that may be the reason. I mean, we're working on it now. There's about three groups I belong to that they're working very hard on it.
Yes.
But in the meantime, we're still talking on about where we could put our mass transit, so on. You know, and it always goes through them.
Hmm.
And I think that's why they're becoming environmentalists, because we've really pounded on them pretty hard.
What you said about environmental groups, the large groups, trying now to recruit from communities of color is the case.
Yeah.
But they have traditionally, the environmental movement has been dominated by about 10 major groups, which have had almost no representation from communities of color. Sierra Club, Audubon Society, Nature Conservancy, World Wildlife Fund. Go on down the line, it's been mostly, it's been overwhelmingly white and mostly rich. But why? Now they're trying to recruit, having limited success. And one, you could say, well, they haven't been invited, but you have your doubts that that's
hard,
a sufficient
reason.
It's hard
to invite them, because
we don't know them.
It's the same problem in the church.
Hmm.
I mean, we go to a downtown church, and there's half a dozen black people in the church, and I don't know of any that are Hispanics, and one Chinese, I think.
Hmm.
And I mean, it's ridiculous, because they're all around down here.
Yeah. Mark, and then Bill. Yeah.
Well, there have been several studies that show that, for example, hazardous waste dumps and other sites are overwhelmingly targeted to low-income and minority communities. The various temporary holding sites for nuclear wastes are all slated to be on Indian reservation, Native American Indian reservation, for example. So that I think it's been inconvenient to listen to minorities and people of color, because in terms of economic development and disposal of waste, those communities have been the communities that have been hurt most. We need some place to put our stuff.
Yeah.
And they're
and that's where we've been putting it. So I would argue it's economic and it's a form of racism.
Why are those the communities that are cited? Why are we putting the stuff there?
It's not just low income, it's really citing places of color. I mean, in terms of the statistic.
A lot of times that's under the guise of rehabilitating a neighborhood building. This toxic waste dump will provide so many more jobs, and mm-hmm. President Bush used to always talk about enterprise zones as rehabilitating inner cities.
It's an urban renewal 20 years before that.
Right. It's just a thin guise for oppressing and already oppressed people.
Well, I was just trying to get the context. Were you asking the question, framing the question in the context of the United States? Because most of the things that I heard mentioned were organizations in this country, or those maybe like Greenpeace that foray abroad. But as much as the environmental problem is a global one now, we should also think about that.
Yeah. Thanks for that clarification. I was talking about the U.S. In this asking this particular question, but I also want to expand it in a little bit. There were a couple of, we're still asking this question, why are there are environmental movements and communities of color. We're asking the question, why are they not known?
Well, I think they are becoming known. I've seen any number of articles in Buzzword and E-Magazine and so forth about minority environmental groups. I don't think that they get much mainstream attention, but then the mainstream press doesn't pay attention to a lot of important things that are going on, so that's not a big surprise to me. On the issue of hazardous waste dumps, I can't remember, I'm a little hazy on the details. There was a woman in California who's been fighting hazardous, helping groups fight hazardous waste dumps in the neighborhoods. And somebody got a hold of a document that circulated throughout the industry that is being hailed in these groups fighting this stuff as a kind of Rosetta Stone, because it is a document telling the companies that are siting these hazardous waste facilities that what neighborhoods to approach and how to approach them. In other words, telling them explicitly to approach neighborhoods, poor areas, rural areas, areas of minority races, because they are considered less capable of fighting these things, less capable of having the organization and the know-how to fight them. And I think that some of those neighborhoods are surprising those companies.
In New York City, next to where I teach, at 137th Street up to 145th, we have the North River Sewage Treatment Plant. It collects all the sewage from the west half of Manhattan. That's a lot. It's an enormous facility. It was scheduled to be located at West 70, in the 70s, in Manhattan. This was the days before community hearings were a requirement of the law, and the developers got wind, no pun intended, of the sewage treatment plant to be scheduled in the West 70s. And influenced the city to relocate it elsewhere. It was relocated from the West 70s to West 135th, which is Harlem. Harlem didn't know about it till all the decisions were in place, but they found out about it. I'm just making your point about some surprise response. Angry, angry, angry. Well, I'll tell you more about it later. But as a consolation prize for putting in the North River Sewage Treatment Plant, which was not supposed to have any odors and not to be in any way a hazardous, toxic site for the neighborhood, we now have a state park. It's quite amazing. On top of the sewage treatment plant. It's the only state park in Manhattan. And it's got a restaurant at the base of the stacks that are spewing out the stuff, as well as ball fields and everything else. The consolation prize to an angered Harlem community was that they would have a big state park, because there are very few parks in Harlem. You go down farther, you got Central Park, you got Riverside Park. Riverside Park stops at 125th Street, which is the south border of Harlem. So that's both your point about looking to relatively unorganized communities, mostly poor, on the one hand, but sometimes reaction. And some of the leadership in that particular campaign was taken by West Harlem Environmental Action. There's an environmental movement in Harlem. Okay, we're still on the question why the environmental movements among communities of color are relatively unknown. Yeah?
I would say one of the reasons is, look at the developing countries of the world, why are they less concerned about environmental problems than we are? Because they're poor, basically. And when you're poor and when tomorrow's meal's coming from, you don't worry about the air pollution and water pollution. Try to survive.
Yeah. Sometimes you worry a lot about it.
Yeah. But you're more worried about eating tomorrow or today.
Yeah. It's a deep conflict. It's the jobs versus having some of the waste in the neighborhood, too. Yeah, sure.
Well, the East Bay area that you're talking about is... Well, there are a lot of blacks in that whole area, and they're very powerful politically.
Mm-hmm.
And they do their own thing pretty much. They've found more success going through their own channels than they have the white channels. And they're very powerful politically, and they're doing a pretty fair job of their... They have a good plan of what they want to do as a black community.
And you're talking about Oakland now, the East Bay.
Yeah, yeah. East Bay.
What I will mention a little bit more in detail later was a major conference held a couple of years ago, the People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit. Who in this room has heard about this summit? A major event of the different environmental groups among communities of color. At Union, where I teach, Union was simply the site of the regional meeting in March of this year of this People's Summit, and about 200 people showed up just for our region. It's hard to get 200 people to show up for a major white environmental meeting, and they were delegates from their communities. Isn't the case that they're not concerned about their neighborhoods or that they're not organized. Something else is going on, and you're saying that the stream of effectiveness is more likely to run stronger and be wider with their own communities than to try to join up with some of the other environmental groups. But I want to push that. Why is that?
Could I ask
Person,
when you say people of color, what do you mean?
Now, well, in this case, and in talking about this country, I mean in this, the way it's shaken out in this particular summit and that organization, is African Americans, Hispanic, and Native Americans. There aren't yet significant numbers of Asian Americans.
The total, in the latest that I've seen in the Encyclopedia Britannica update, is one in four in this country is now a minority. The blacks lead, the Hispanics are sneaking up very fast, and then there's a few percent of Pacific and Eurasian and so on. So that's one in four now.
Mm-hmm.
And how about the Hispanics? Are they, do they have...
They're in this complex.
Right, but are they less oriented to environmental thing?
Well, no, this is why I want to push this a bit now. There is, in addition to some issues that run deep and wide in this society, namely issues of majority-minority, issues of racism, are there additional reasons that have to do with environment and environmental issues? Is my question clear? I mean, we could answer the lack of the fact that we don't know them, as in the churches that you mentioned. That could be one kind of question. It would cut across all issues, probably. Now, are there any issues that have to do with, particularly with environment? Joel, and then we'll just come around. Yeah.
I guess that the traditional environmental organizations have been composed of people who weren't dissatisfied with their own personal or local situation, but were always identifying some place out there, some pristine area that was in danger or some devastated area, but it was never close to home. And I would guess that when minorities talk, and it's true of my rural small town, when we talk about environmental problems, we're talking about home. And they're very specific and particular, and they don't lend themselves well to national marketing. Mm-hmm. So I would say it's a difference between the location of the environmental problem. If the location is at home, I don't think they'll serve the interests of the national organization. Mm-hmm.
I want to hear the other side. I want to say something to that, but I want to hear from the two of you first. Yeah.
I think even when it isn't a case that a particular group, recruiting or whatever, is concerned about pristine areas, but is concerned about local issues, I think that the airplay that environmentalism has gotten is about pristine areas. And so if that's the impression, then particularly urban people of color are probably not going to be interested unless you can explain that this is about everybody. I mean, I belong to an environmental group in Seattle, and we had a specific outreach project to minority communities last summer, and the guy who was leading that project was at one point speaking to a group of teenage African-American girls, and one of them said, well, what does the environment have to do with me as an African-American living in Seattle? Nothing. Because that was her view. We're off in the mountains or whatever, saving endangered species. That wasn't our aim, but if you're not doing what the press is promoting, then you have to explain yourself, and that takes time.
Mm-hmm. What I was going to say was basically the synthesis of what you've been saying is, but to add to it, I think another thing is that general perceptions as they go towards minority activism are they're always trying to, you know, push through their agenda. And I think in terms of a mainstream focus and what we see through mainstream eyes or how the environmental movement is understood on the whole, it goes against what minority community activists might be trying to push in their own community, might be going against that. Therefore, people are saying, well, they're just trying to push their own radical, you know, black agenda or their radical Latino agenda or whatever, and they can't mainstream environmentalists, mainstream media are unable to see it as an environmental issue. They see it more as a black thing or a Latino thing, that they're just trying to further their own agenda and get things their own way.
And I suppose the deepening gap in organization, if you get more organized in these community of color and your mainstream, or what we would call mainstream or large environmental groups, continue on their way, then you exacerbate that because you have a sense of organizations at odds. Well, just yes, please.
It
I think another issue really is what is ecology to most movements, and that I think we worry a lot more in Minnesota about the wolf and the moose than we might the interaction of own members of our own species. And really don't deal with how we treat each other ecologically. We're a heck of a lot more worried about the wolf or the elk or whatever, and not in terms of that, you know, what happens to the environment of the Indian and all of this. And I think exactly what has been mentioned before. I mean, that's the racism, really, is that we're not dealing very well with how we get along.
I want to comment on this just a bit, and then just give you a little bit more information about kind of the history of some of it. This is going in the direction that I think we need to include. There are many directions to go. This one needs to be included. And the reason I mentioned the contrast between designating an area in the Berkeley Hills with limited human access and no human beings are to live there, designating an ecological study area, but not inner city Oakland, is because the definition of what is an environmental problem differs so much. If in Harlem you ask for a meeting on an environmental issue and it were picked up in the way in which you mentioned it is often communicated, preservation of wilderness, protection of endangered species, conservation of nature. Now, preservation and conservation are the roots, again, no pun intended, of the environmental movement. That has been the philosophy, is conservation and preservation. That won't get you very far if you're in Harlem, because you don't talk in the first place about environmental issues. You talk in the first place about quality of life issues. And included in that are matters of environment. And environment becomes a word, something in the way in which you're using ecology. What is the whole character of our community? Just to extend the earlier example, the North River Sewage Treatment Plant in West Harlem is next to the Marine Exchange Terminal. The Marine Exchange Terminal is a place where all the garbage trucks from the upper west side of Manhattan come early in the morning and put the the garbage on the barges that take it out to North Gills landfill on Staten Island, which when it's filled will be the highest point on the eastern seaboard. We're going to build a ski lodge there and we're going to make a lot of money. So right next to the sewage treatment plant, then you have this stream of trucks every morning unloading. Now the garbage goes down the river, but of course the truck pollution stays in more or less in the neighborhood. Across the street from both of those on the river is one of the 8 bus terminals for city buses in Manhattan. 7 of the 8 bus terminals in Manhattan are located in Harlem. So the buses, no matter where they're going in the city, at least 1/7 of them, let's say, are going to be coming there to be parked when they're not in use and leaving from there. Those 3 facilities are all in the very same neighborhood as a rather large grade school. Now the asthma rates in Harlem are among the highest in the United States, and they've gone up dramatically in the last 10 years. The New England Journal of Medicine is now about to publish the outcome of a study of asthma among children in Harlem. 3 diseases in Harlem now are are of what the people in the area call epidemic proportions: TB, asthma, and AIDS. If you talked about an environmental problem and meant even the North River sewage treatment plant, you'd get some attention. You got to talk about asthma, quality of life issues.
Ask a question. Wasn't the question framed a little more narrowly? Why don't the minority groups' environmental efforts, why aren't they more cooperative jointly? Not why aren't minority groups more interested in the environment? That's pretty easy, because if you have higher priorities like food and shelter and you have nothing to lose, you're not as interested as those that have a lot to lose and don't want to lose them in the backyard. But isn't this question of why they don't work together more? I can think of several reasons. One is the mistrust and the suspicion yeah. that there's some other agenda. And the other is that they've seen the dominant group put things yeah. in their backyard like that.
Yeah.
And they may not feel, they may also feel that if they join the dominant yeah. group, they'd be looked at as Uncle Toms or selling yeah. out by their own races.
Yeah, and they'd be more effective. Now, all of that is a part of this, but the original question is, why aren't the environmental movements among people of color better known? And all I'm saying now is that the very philosophy and definition of what is included and not included in environmental issues is very different.
Well, the media, the press, the television,
yeah.
How do we learn about these things?
Yeah, see, that's
they're
true.
Prejudiced against that.
Yeah.
What can we do about it? I guess that's going to be your yeah. next question.
No, my next, I'm going to hold it off just a second.
One quick question. What's the size of these groups you're talking about?
Well, you got me there. I don't know in terms of total numbers.
Far smaller than the CRP.
My guess is that is so. I don't know. That would be significant. And it probably is now information that is available because of this summit, and that's been a kind of organizational effort. What I want to do now, because we've got to finish this up in about 20 minutes, is just share a little bit of information with you so that I can get to a second question. For it isn't actually that one. Where do we go? What do we do about it? It's a very far-reaching question that I think we need to answer maybe before that good question. just a little history here. The term environmental racism was coined by Ben Chavis, who at the time was the executive director of the United Church of Christ's Commission on Racial Justice. Ben Chavis has now left that post because he's been elected the head of the NAACP. He used it to describe what he and others saw as they protested the dumping of 32,000 cubic yards of soil contaminated with highly toxic PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, in mostly black Warren County, North Carolina. The 32,000 cubic yards of this contaminated soil had been scooped up from alongside roadways in 14 North Carolina counties where they had been illegally dumped in 1978. African Americans protested the construction of this PCB landfill in the small town of Afton, North Carolina. That was the first time, actually, in U.S. history that African American citizens were arrested and jailed over the placement of a hazardous waste site. And it was in this context that Ben Chavis began to talk about environmental racism. The groundbreaking study on environmental racism to which Mark Edwards alluded here came in 1987 It was conducted by the United Church of Christ's Commission on Racial Justice, headed by Ben Chavis. And as it turns out, it has set off a chain reaction of studies about the correlation of racism and poverty and environmental quality in communities of color and among poor people of all colors. We now have a whole set of studies that looks at what the connection is between the location of toxic waste and other things, air pollution, environmentally caused diseases, etc. Yeah. I put on the board here a couple of sources. Al Gore's book, Earth and the Balance, which is really quite a fine book, and he wrote it himself. He really is very well versed in these issues, gives some attention to the United Church of Christ study. It isn't, you won't find it in detail there. But that's one indication that it has made a mark. We in the church rarely lead on any of these issues, so once in a while when we do take some leadership, you like to point it out anyway. And then a little later I'm going to talk about environmental apartheid and Vandana Shiva, who is an Indian, Asian Indian scientist, has made that something of an international issue. And her book is entitled Staying Alive, Women, Ecology, and Development. I'll say something about it in a minute. Anyway, the United Church of Christ's 1987 study, which is entitled Toxic Waste and Race in the United States, was deceptively easy to do, and yet enormously significant. And this is the dream of every doctoral student in Christian ethics, to find this kind of simple and significant study correlation. The UCC staff simply took United States government and other census data on where people lived by race. And then they took U.S. and other government other data on the location of toxic waste disposal sites. And then they did the same for income levels. Had all of the information right at their fingertips. Didn't have to do one solid field visit. The highest correlation was along lines of race. Higher than income, though that's very significant as well. That is, most of these dumps are in poor neighborhoods. But race is the single highest correlation. In the 5+ years since 1987, it's become clear that people of color are not only disproportionately exposed to toxic and other hazardous waste facilities, but also disproportionately exposed to lead poisoning, pesticide contamination, and myriad forms of air, land, and water pollution. The related and demonstrated consequence is a rise in the incidences in those communities of infant mortality, cancer, respiratory diseases, and other public health problems which are related to such environmental issues. And I told you a little bit about West Harlem. Since this United Church of Christ study in 87, the EPA, stimulated in part, Environmental Protection Agency, by the reports of these environmental groups among communities of color, have undertaken their own studies, and if you want to look at some of them, I'm not going to give you statistics now, but it shows you by race, white, African American, Hispanic is always fuzzy because it's not race, it's a language designation, Native American. If you want to see some of the EPA data on that, you're welcome to do so. Basically, it substantiates the UCC. Okay, just two more items, a couple more items, and then I want to pose the second question. The This is sometimes then known as eco-racism and the correlation with income as eco-classism. But since we know that women and children are particularly vulnerable and growing stratum among the poor of all communities, white included, there is also a gender issue involved in environmental issues, and Vandana Shiva looks at that worldwide, but especially among women in poor countries. But it's also true in this country. Some of my students who are from West Virginia can tell you tales that will raise a hair on the back of your neck about environmental problems in poor communities, poor white communities in Appalachia. But now I want to pick up on the comment here, the question here about whether I was talking about a national focus or more than that, and shift actually from a national to an international and mention the term of Vandana Shiva, environmental apartheid, and ask what that might pertain to. Her contention is, this is a matter of much debate, but I'm just going to go with the case as she makes it. Her contention is that modern economic development, by and large, is exploitative of most poor countries. It is hard on their natural environment and their natural resources. Now they have an additional factor to deal with, a couple of them. One is that they have far fewer means to address the environmental problems that afflict them by their participation in international economic order, that is to say, transition to becoming industrial nations and trading nations. So they don't have the means to do the fixing up that rich countries do. So take a country like Brazil, for example, or India. But poor countries also, Vandana Shiva says, are now the new targets for exporting environmental wastes. And bargains are being made because they also desperately need money, jobs, etc. And they are also the places of many manufacturing sites which stand to gain both from low wages and less stringent environmental standards. So there's a relocation of industry, and again, they need investment and jobs, etc. So her point is that what's happening, folks, is that all of the dynamics are playing out along the lines of environmental apartheid. That is, we'll have a world divided between relatively affluent, relatively clean, relatively spacious, and mostly white populations, and a world that'll be mostly poor, mostly dirty, mostly crowded, and overwhelmingly people of color. Now, it's more complex than that, but you see the direction of developments, at least she wants you to see that, and to see why it looks a little bit like a kind of South Africa on a global scale, and that the issues environment play into that. Now, my question for our discussion is this. Some people argue, and many people hope, I'm certainly one of them, that the common threat to planetary life and systems, the common threat to the biosphere, the common threat to ecosystems will mean, and already has meant in some cases, new levels of local, national, and international cooperation. That is to say, you'll get more human cooperation. You'd get maximum human cooperation if we had a serious threat of an invasion from Mars. That would be the best thing that could happen. Short of that, the best thing that can happen is the realization of a common threat. We're all planetary systems. There's only one ozone layer. So it's one world. And the argument among many is that one world, one Earth, I should say, we're not yet one world. We're one Earth without being one world. But that the common threat, because we are all citizens of one planet, will mean unprecedented cooperation. That's the argument, the sense of our country, the planet. Others argue that environmental issues only exacerbate standing social justice or social injustice issues along lines of race, class, gender, culture, and national origin. That is, that the threats to life don't mean working together for the common good. The threats set in motion the dynamics of the compulsions of survival. In some quarters, and the effort to hold on to an affluent way of life in other quarters, so that environmentalism makes worse the divisions in the world. Now, which is it?
Is Vandana basically only exploit the argument you talked about and not the other side? There's a strong argument that we're not in this century in the kind of imperialism we look back in history. If these trades are made with poorer countries, or you bring in plants and you do other things, inevitably it brings up their standard of living where they have to consider these environmental issues. Mm-hmm. So one could make a very strong argument that you're really, in a relatively short period of time, improved the situation of that country. And also the recognition and the education that we are, as you stated, in one world. Mm-hmm. So it's everybody's concern. Mm-hmm.
She takes on that argument, and we can't take it up here. She doesn't believe it. She thinks that model of development doesn't work, and especially not for women. Secondly, she thinks it's unsustainable. Environmentally unsustainable in our kind of work. So it's not an argument for the future. I mean, that's
her. As I perceive her argument, it's instability. Things will get worse and worse where a small group will exploit the other.
No, her argument is for another model of development.
And she proposes
that? Yeah, yeah. All right, to this question, whether the environmental threats make for a kind of more cooperation and a common cause, or whether they intensify divisions.
I would say that after kind of following the Earth Summit this last year, I think I saw to some degree national in terms of a national cooperation, it seems to be exacerbating the problem. I think people are kind of tight, throwing punches at each other. We saw, Brazil saying, you keep telling us to get our act together when it's not possible. You're not allowing us to develop in a way that allows us to sustain our rainforest and do this, that, and the other. I think in some cases, we will see cooperation at a grassroots level, undoubtedly, but on a national, international level, or between nation, I don't think that will happen. I think it's happening with NAFTA right now. I think in some way proposed a commission, like a tri-national commission, to monitor environmental crimes by the transnational corporations that would be set up according to the NAFTA agreement.
but it had been shot down by specifically the Mexican government, because they just think that it infringes upon their national sovereignty. It seems to be, on a national level, impossible, I would say.
I'm very conscious of the time, but I do want to come back to you and complexify it just a little bit. Internationally, what you say is certainly in part the case, and as was reflected in Rio de Janeiro a year from today. On the other hand, some international treaties were signed, very significant ones. And take, for example, the agreements on, prior to the Earth Summit, on levels of ozone destructive materials into the air. Those treaties came about faster and were revised upward in terms of more rigorous standards in shorter periods of time than almost anything that we have in history. I mean, there's been some very fast movement internationally between nations on environmental issues. It really was quite extraordinary. Now, at the same time, in Rio de Janeiro, there's no question that the most far-reaching, not simply proposals, but agreements, and in general, far-reaching activity, was among the non-governmental organizations that came there. And they hammered out, it was either 28 or 32 treaties among themselves. Now those don't have the backing of enforcement. There's no agency that they're strictly voluntary. But it's still quite significant that this vast number of international non-governmental organizations from poor countries as well as rich, I mean, there were 14 of them, 100 of them from Brazil alone. Now, that was a host country. But it says something about the fact that they do exist. There was a lot of cooperation, so on the non-governmental basis.
But that would be considered the grassroots level.
Yeah, it is.
Kind of what I would.
And the United Nations, for the Rio conference, invited non-governmental organizations for the first time in the history of the UN in its conference planning, big international conference planning, invited non-governmental organizations into the planning of the conference itself. Not just to hold a parallel conference on their own, it's always done that. They invited them into it because they know that these issues will not be addressed without widespread support from the base. And the NGOs know, unless you've got some agency like an international agency or national governments pushing from their side to put it into law, into policy, and with backed by enforcement, NGO work will go for naught. You won't get compliance on simply a voluntary basis. You've got to have that kind of backing. So it's a little bit more complicated than no national action, only grassroots action. It's an interplay there. Yeah. Anybody else have some judgment about whether this means tougher times and greater and worse divisions? I mean, does the social justice agenda get more difficult or not? Bill?
I think that we're almost just shooting up pie in the sky stuff here. How are you going to get this stuff down to the ordinary citizen, of which there are a great many, so that they understand what the whole problem is and they get personally involved in that? You take a city the size of Seattle, most of them could care less. Now, how are you going to disturb that lackadaisical attitude all over the country and get them really thinking about what the possibilities are for self-destruction. It's going to be a fighting battle all the way up the hill. I hate to be so negative about this, but I'm being realistic about it.
At the same time, a lot of the initiatives have been local initiatives. And the more it becomes, who over here was talking about local problems, the more it becomes a local problem, the more response you get. Yeah, Lou?
I think there's another dimension to all ecology problems that will create or will be disturbed more and more deeply by this division of the classes, and that's human population growth. Yeah. And if we whites, with our smaller families, you know, look out at the rest of the world and say it's all their fault, look at how they're breeding, look how they're crowding the world, look at how the population is exploding, without the compassion that goes with helping this problem. I mean, the human population is causing devastating, frightening figures for the future.
Yes.
And whether you're talking about pristine wilderness and room for the elephants, mm-hmm. you're seeing the population move into the areas where the gorillas have lived and the elephants used to graze and so forth. But for me, I haven't resolved this huge problem in my own mind. And how do we as a nation, do we take Reagan's thing where we cut off all aid to any country that dares to have an abortion, not caring anything about the babies that are being born, and just cut off all aid in that way? Or thank heavens, I think Clinton is starting to restore some of that, those drastic cuts. And yet we can be so judgmental about human population. What are we doing to help them control population? Are we going to care more about the elephants than we do about the people? The whole problem of human population is so involved with environmental, and it's one of the big gaps of understanding between our high-class affluent society, which has small families, and poor families for whom the children are their social security and their servants in the job, in the business, in the fields. The children are much more than just someone to be pampered and given everything they want and go to school and come out rich themselves. It's so intertwined.
That's such a big one, and one of the most volatile of all, as you well know. To bring this up as a discussion issue internationally is one of the most volatile areas. There is, we should all know about it at least, a UN conference in Cairo this year on population issues. So it is
next year.
Yeah, 1994, thank you.
Does Shiva address this at all in her Women, Ecology, and Development?
Well, yes, in part.
Because as an Indian woman, she must surely feel the pain of the little girls that suffer in India, many of whom are killed or aborted or thrown on the pier with their husband or whatever they do to women in India.
Listen, folks, we got church. Joe, why don't you be the last? There are other hands, but I think we can take one more, probably.
I think the scenario that scares me the most is that one, that if environmental problems begin to impinge on the health of whole populations, the thing that frightens me is that the affluent and the powerful will decide that they can buy time by just letting the rest of the poor world suffer the consequences of environmental disaster, and sort of take a social Darwinism approach, and then buy time for the affluent, and just let. And I sense that's almost already happening. That we've stepped in kind of half-heartedly in various places around the world, where environmental disasters and famine have been we're kind of falling up our hands and see it doesn't work. And I know I have lots of people I talk to that say, well, we have enough problems here. I think we need to let them worry about their own problems.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's almost on the edge of becoming sort of entering the realm of possibility that we could just let the world go to hell from on our own.
This is like most other sessions I hold, and it just never quits. But it has to stop anyway. And so we need to conclude now and take it up in some other, maybe the same or some other room around here in the future. Thank you.